Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Adam Weymouth talking about the Kings of the Yukon.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for skipping the football to be here. We promise to get you out by the second half, okay? I'm going to start by reading the introduction from the book. The river is flowing backwards, back up from the sea. They swim through silt, eyes wide, unblinking. 30, 40, 50 pounds of flesh, many thousands of them. Their backs speckled like frog spawn, the blush of their bellies, where the silver of their flanks fades into a deep and meaty rose. Jaws gawping, lips beginning to curve in upon themselves like pliers, propping their mouths ajar so that the river flows right through them. And yet for the rest of their lives, these salmon will not eat, they will not drink. The organs that sustain them, the kidneys and the stomach, are shrinking as they sense the sweet water that they have not known since they were smolts, finger big, years back. Familiar scents long forgotten are triggering changes in their brains and in their bodies. Their chemistry has new priorities now. The ovaries of the female hen will swell to a sixth of her body weight during her swim upriver. The cock's testes will increase fivefold. For several years, the salmon have roamed in schools throughout the Bering Sea, the chain of the Aleutians, the Sea of Okhotsk, ranging as far as the coasts of Japan. Their many species mingle. They travel further than science can reach, and much of what they eat and where they winter can only be surmised. The Yupik say that they live in human form beneath the waves, five houses, one for each tribe, and at the Salmon King's behest each spring, they pull on their fins and silver skins and make for the human world. In the late Arctic spring, impelled before the others, the kings turn for North America's west coast. California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, Alaska. They have iron in their brains. Their compasses have led them here. Now they scent their birthing pools. A chemical mix of vegetable and mineral unique to the waters of their birth that draws them on a thread up several thousand miles of river. They can distinguish a single drop from their home river amongst 2 million gallons of seawater. The movement of one, changing direction, pulses through the rest, electric. At times they crest the surface, a dark, sleek back, a dorsal fin, undulating like dolphins. These fish are many pounds of muscle, toned through years of swimming headlong into Pacific storms, and their flesh is red as blood. They force against the Yukon's current, shouldering their way upriver, tacking crosswise through the flow, setting their fins like sails. Their shadows pass like clouds across the bottom. They rest in the eddies of boulders on the river's bed, erratics left behind by glaciers. At the river's mouth, the water is still brackish, the current compounded with the flow of the tide. But it is diluting, and as they move further up the delta, the sea slackens off its hold, resigning, letting them go. On this great in-breath of the land, the kings spread up through the waters and their tributaries, permeating the watershed. Eventually, they will push thousands of miles into the continent's interior. They will reach mountain lakes. They will reach the clouds. I first went to Alaska in 2013. And I went, I suppose, because I had an idea in my head of what I thought Alaska was like, and I wanted to see if it in any way conformed to the reality. And I'm not alone in that. Only 39% of Alaskans were born in Alaska, which is to say that most people lived there, have moved there, and most people have decided to stay. Alaska, with its winters of minus 40, doesn't really permit ambivalence. And people have gone there for all sorts of reasons. People have gone there for the rumored riches of oil and gold and fur. People have gone there because of the military. People have gone there because they're trying to get out of a relationship or stay one step ahead of the law or stay one step ahead of reality. I lost count of the amount of people that told me that they'd moved to Alaska because it was as far away from their parents as they could possibly live and still be in America. And a lot of people go to Alaska for the same reason that I went, which was I had some idea of some wild, untamed land. I'd seen White Fang at the cinema when I was about 8 years old, and I'd grown up reading books of Jack London and Farley Mowat. There was the BBC wildlife documentaries. More recently, I'd seen the film and read the book of Into the Wild about Chris McCandless in his early 20s who'd gone to Alaska to pit himself against it and ended up starving to death in the wilderness. And things like that I felt in some way I couldn't really resist. And ostensibly I'd gone there as a journalist. I'd gone to study stories of climate change and resource extraction in Alaska. And there's absolutely no shortage of stories of climate change and resource extraction in Alaska. And that first time I traveled around the state more or less following my nose, I went to the village of Point Hope, way, way up the top in northwest Alaska. It's a strong contender for being the longest continually settled site in the Americas. People have been there for 6,000 years hunting whales, and their lives are now rapidly changing as Shell explores for oil offshore, just as 100 years ago their lives rapidly changed as people came for the oil from the whales. I went to the village of Chicken, population 23, winter population 7, where gold panners all across America come to celebrate the 4th of July. I went to the Prince William Sound, 25 years on from the Exxon Valdez spill, where they're still digging crude out of the beaches just a few inches down. And I went out on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which is this bulge pointing out from the western tip of Alaska. It's one of the biggest river deltas in the world, about the size of England. And I'd been invited out there by a man called Mike Williams, who was then the chief of the Yupik Nation. I'd heard about Mike because he'd traveled all over the world talking about the changes that his people were experiencing as the climate warmed. And Mike lives in a very far-flung village called Akiak, hundreds of miles from the nearest road, and all flights to get to Akiak have to go through the hub town of Bethel. And whilst I was in Bethel, Mike suggested that I might as well sit in on a court case that was happening at the time. There were 23 Yupik fishermen who were on trial for catching king salmon when there was a ban placed on them the year previously in 2012. Except getting caught for them had not been an accident. They'd press released their intentions before setting out. And Mike sat me down and he said to me, "Gandhi had his salt and we have our salmon." I sat in that court case for 4 days and I saw two very different ways of looking at the world being forced up against each other. No one was denying that the king salmon were in peril. Their numbers had crashed in recent years and no one was able to explain what was happening. And the Alaska Department of Fish and Game had decided to step in and restrict the commercial had been restricted a long time ago, but now they're restricting even the subsistence catching of the indigenous people. Whereas the Yupik were defending themselves, saying going out and catching this salmon was not just important nutritionally to fill their larders for the winter, but it was equally important culturally. It was part of their spiritual heritage, and they were defending themselves based on the First Amendment. There were tears in the courtroom, and the judge was very sympathetic to the indigenous case, but eventually he found them guilty. He found that the state had requirement enough to be putting this ban on because numbers of king salmon were so critical to try and ensure it for future generations. So I went back to England and I wrote an article about the story and I followed what was happening in 2014 and again in 2015. A ban was placed on the catching of king salmon along the length of the Yukon River, 2,000 miles through Canada and Alaska, a totally unprecedented move as numbers continued to crash. And it felt to me that there was a much larger story to be told. And I started plotting about a way that I could get back. Now the Yukon, which is the big black line going across there that rises in Canada. Can you hear me when I still face this way? Or do I need to, yeah. And flows all across Alaska and down to the Bering Sea. It's the longest salmon run in the world. There's 5 species of Pacific salmon, unlike the Atlantic salmon, of which there's only one. And it's the kings that travel farthest, which is to say the few salmon that make it all the way up the Yukon, entering from the Bering Sea and finish up at McNeil Lake in the Pelly Mountains in Canada, have traveled further up a river than any other fish on the planet, nearly 2,000 miles. And in the summer of 2016, I caught a float plane up to McNeil Lake to go and find them. And I did. On the very first morning in McNeil Lake, this is the life cycle of the king salmon, I found the parr, these very small, maybe an inch long salmon that were feeding on my porridge as I washed up my breakfast that first morning. The salmon have this remarkable life cycle. They'll spend their entire adult lives at sea, and when they're impelled to return, they swim up through the Yukon, guided, as I talked about in the introduction there, by their sense of smell. They think they use the stars and the iron in their brains to guide them to the mouth of the Yukon, and then following the mix of chemicals and minerals unique to the very pool that they were born in, they'll swim 2,000 miles upriver without eating or drinking. By the time that they arrive at McNeil Lake, they're understandably exhausted. Their entire bodies have changed, so much so that people used to think they were two entirely different fish, the fish in freshwater and the fish in saltwater. And their ability to straddle those two environments is remarkable. It's as though we could go back and forth between the Earth and the Moon at will. And on entering into the fresh water, their bodies will change, their mouths will elongate into this, what's called a kype, almost like a crocodile. The king's colours will change from a silver to a deep and bloody rose. The chum goes red and bright green. They're absolutely remarkable, different looking fish. Their scales get subsumed into their bodies. And so by the time that they spawn, they're really on their last legs, if you'll pardon the metaphor, and they'll start rotting as they stand. They'll be guarding the pools where they've spawned, and they'll start to just fade away and eventually be spawned out. The eggs will wait all winter beneath the gravel bed, and the next summer, the par will hatch. And my plan, as the par flowed out down McNeil Lake, 2,000 miles to the sea to begin their adult lives, was to follow them. I'd done long journeys across land before. In 2010, I walked from England to Istanbul as part of an exploration of pilgrimage in the 21st century. And I'd enjoyed something about that. There was a way of moving from place to place by a series of coincidences and connections that I hadn't really had working as a journalist. I found I'd meet someone in a village and they'd tell me about their cousin in the next village who had a friend in the next village, and I'd got a coincidental cross-section of the place that I was walking through. And I also liked the way that people would relate to me, that I wasn't just parachuting in as a journalist, but I'd turned up in a way that they could understand over land and I was carrying on. And if I was going to follow the Yukon from one end to the other, then to do it in a canoe seemed to make the most sense to me. I'd read this quote of Bill Mason's, who's a Canadian, who did more in the 1970s perhaps than anyone else to popularize canoeing. And he said, "When you look at the face of Canada and study the geography carefully, you come away with a feeling that God could have designed the canoe first and then set about to conceive a land in which it could flourish." I put together a proposal and I sold it to a publisher, and it was only sitting in a meeting just after the book had sold that the publisher asked me how much canoeing experience I had. And I said I'd spent about an afternoon in a canoe, and I started to realize what I might be getting myself into. It's very hard to practice for the Yukon in England. I spent an afternoon on the Medway and spent a few days paddling down the Wye, a couple days on the Dart, and these are absolute trickles to Canadian eyes. The Yukon is an altogether different beast. It flows 10, 15 miles an hour at certain points. At other places, it stretches 2-3 miles wide. Where the Yukon meets the Bering Sea, it's 7 miles from bank to bank. It's an absolutely enormous river with this huge load of silt so that you can't even see a knuckle beneath the surface when you put your finger in. I was reluctant to do it by myself, and for the first couple of weeks, I managed to find a gentleman by the name of Hector McKenzie, a Scot who'd moved to Canada from Scotland as a young man in his 20s, and now in his 70s, he had a lifetime's worth of experience of paddling and traveling in Canada. Unlike here, where it's possible to find maps and YouTube videos and all sorts of things that can really tell you where you're going to go, we had very little information about what the Nisutlin River, the first tributary we were paddling down on out of McNeil Lake, was going to be like. And so Hector had suggested that I took both him and a raft with me for the first bit to try and make it safer. This is a bit from that first time. I've just noticed, oh, it's counting down, great. On the fourth day, we come to the rapids. I had a sense of foreboding in camp as we rigged the raft that morning, strapping down the gear, attaching throw bags and flip lines, discussing eventualities. What to do if one of us falls out? What to do if both of us fall out? How we go about finding each other? What to do if we lost the boat? It is a long, long walk to Whitehorse. We have little idea what to expect. And then for an hour or two, we drift along pleasant meanders through sun-baked forests. We see golden iron canvasback, pintail and widgeon. Mountains recede in deepening shades, and I'm almost lulled into forgetting what's approaching when we turn a bend and see ahead of us a line of rippling white stretching from bank to bank. "That's us," says Hector with a twinkle, and we fall into them. The mutter of the river becomes an all-consuming roar. The waves rise up, malevolent, great troughs and burbling peaks. The raft bucks over them, and we dig the paddles deep and try to hold her straight. Behind rocks that have tumbled from distant mountainsides are gaping holes that would flip the raft like a penny. The river wants to take the boat in there, and we strained to keep her out. Back up, says Hector, unfalteringly calm. Sweep hard, harder, now. We swing sideways in a trench of water and the river sloshes over us, and shamefully I dive for the deck. The water barrels over me. The river heaves and flexes beneath my hands. The raft pivots where Hector jams the paddle in, and then we pop from the end of the rapid, soaked, unscathed, and I get back in my seat. That was meant to be the easy one, he says, smiling, as though to say, well, we're committed now. They blur one into another. We climb and plunge, the waves breaking in our faces, wiping the water away to sea and bending back into the stroke. The river lunging, shaking, clawing at the raft. Well, look at that, says Hector, pointing at ducks as we shoot over another wave. Another pair of harlequin. How fascinating. I think that I am scared, but each time we emerge from the end of the rapid, I find myself yearning for more. And there are more. They are continuous. We pick a line down the left bank, trying to dodge the worst of it, but the flow pushes us out into the middle channel, and we ride it, finding ourselves in an eddy on a sharp bend, the current pushing us one way, but not enough for us to miss the mound of rock that is now looming at the top of the next falls. I hear the edge in Hector's voice as we heave to try and pull right, and we do, grazing past the rock, gazing into the hole that yawns beyond it, and I'm looking behind, and Hector's shouting, back, back, and I realise we're rowing backwards past this next one, and we make it, just, turn to right ourselves, and on it goes. And all I can keep thinking is, the salmon swim up this. And then in a moment it is over. The river broadens, slows, the land seems to flatten out. The sand bed sucks the current from the water. We lie back and float, and let the sun dry us off. I look across at Hector. We're both grinning, with adrenaline, with relief. I used to scare myself about once a week, he says. Now I try and keep it to once a year. I hope that that was it. For about 2 weeks, we paddled down the Nasutlin, camping each night, setting up a tent, carrying on in the morning. We switched to a canoe, which was able to hold a lot of gear at certain points. We had to carry weeks' worth of food at a time. Hector left me just as I came into the village of Teslin, the first village that I came to on the length of the Yukon. Teslin is a Tlingit village, population of about 450 people. And it was once a remote bush community until the Alaska Highway went in the 1940s, put in by the Americans in case the Japanese turned up via Alaska. And Teslin went almost overnight from being a remote bush community to being an overnight drive to Vancouver. I met elders in the village that remembered the bulldozers cresting the hills and forging a path towards town. The rate of change in Northwest Canada and Alaska, unlike the rest of North America, where there's been a continuation from 1492 onwards, has been compressed into this incredibly tight range of a few decades. Really, until the gold rush in the Klondike of 1896, very few of the indigenous people had ever seen a white man. And following the gold rush, there was the flu pandemic in 1910, the missionaries have arrived, the residential schools, and then certain villages began to be connected to the highways. And in quite a short space of time, these places went from lifestyles which hadn't significantly changed for several thousand years to being very much on the Western map. The previous life in Teslin would have been a semi-nomadic existence, although rotating through a series of camps which would have stayed the same each year. People would have moved from a moose camp in the fall to berry picking camp, found somewhere slightly warmer to try and sit out the winter, hunting muskrat in the spring. And every summer, the families would have come down to ancestral fishing points on the Yukon where they knew there was going to be a reliable arrival of king salmon. As I've said, the king salmon travels the furthest. It's the only salmon that reaches as far as Teslin. And people would have their fishing spots to harvest this reliable annual glut of protein that turned up every year. And as such, it was quite an easy time rather than chasing a moose across the tundra or the backbreaking work of berry picking. This was a time when people could set their nets and sit back and wait for the bounty to turn up. And that was part of the reason that it became not just very important nutritionally for putting away food that was going to last them through these brutal winters of minus 40, minus 50 degrees, but also this very important cultural time. It was a time for families to get together, for marriages to be formed, for people to share stories. It was a time to educate the children and teach them how to cut and prepare this fish, how to respect the water. And even though life in Teslin has changed a lot since then, especially since the road came through, there are now stores, and so people can go to the stores and buy the food that they need. They can, there's jobs, and so people now have to manage their subsistence lifestyle around having to turn up for work every day. There's tourism and there's other ways of generating income. The fish camp is one of those parts of the culture which has remained, that every year it coincides, people take a month off work, or it coincides with the summer vacation from the schools. People will head out to these ancestral spots that they've been going to for thousands of years, set their nets and sit back and enjoy the summertime. That's how it used to be. Except 20 years ago, Teslin decided to stop catching king salmon almost entirely. The elders had been telling them for a long time that there was something up with the fish, that the runs were massively down. Historically, in the 20th century, runs have been about 300,000 fish. In 2013, just 37,000 fish came back into the Yukon. Teslin restricted their fishing to 5 days of the week, to 3 days of the week, to 1 day of the week, but nothing really seemed to make a difference. And so 20 years ago, they decided to stop fishing entirely. And not only did that mean that they were now having to buy their food in, it meant that these cultural traditions were not getting passed down. Teslin now get their food from a village called Atlin, several hundred miles to the south, where the salmon are still coming on a different river system. And there's teenagers, people older than teenagers, that now associate the start of the salmon run with the sound of the planes turning up from the mountains to the south. And these days they call it flying fish. And as I paddled down the Yukon, I started to get this sense that all the way down the river, as the salmon starts to disappear, these lives are starting to unravel as well. And that's not just the lives of the people. I forgot to show these two, but these are some photos taken from people preparing salmon. This is chopping the heads, and this is one of the smokehouses with the salmon hanging up to dry. As I started paddling down the Yukon, I got a sense not only was it affecting the people, but it's also affecting the ecosystems. There's perhaps no image more iconic of the north than a bear standing haunch deep in a river fielding leaping salmon like a goalkeeper. The salmon's absolutely integral to the bear's survival. The amount of salmon that the bear consumes will determine how many cubs that she has the next spring. A bear can get through 40 salmon in 8 hours. And about 50 different mammals will make use of the king salmon as it makes its journey upriver. It will affect how successful eagles are. The amount of salmon that eagles are able to eat depends when the chicks will hatch, which depends when they fledge and their survival rates. The carcasses which are left behind by the eagles will be used by the seagulls as they make their migration south. As the carcasses rot, they bring in insects, which then bring in the birds and the amphibians, and the whole ecosystem is based around the salmon. To give one example, the plant kneeling angelica will time its flowering for about 10 days after the salmon arrive. That's the point when the carcasses are starting to rot in the soil, and that's the point where the blowflies come in. The kneeling angelica relies on the blowflies as its pollinator. The blowflies rely on the kneeling angelica as energy to reproduce. The maggots that are laid and will feast on the carcasses break the salmon down into the soil, and so it continues, so that the level of nutrients in the soil is higher than commercial grade fertilizer in places where the salmon runs are strong. Because the salmon's bringing all these nutrients which have been washed down by the Yukon away from the land back up it, so that if you trace the phosphorus and the carbon and the nitrogen in the trees that are growing along the river's banks, you can trace that right to the bottom of the oceans. And fish biologists can gauge the state of the salmon run by how well those forests are doing. So at every point in the system, the salmon are integral. And yet no one knows why they're disappearing. And the purpose of this journey was to try and speak to a lot of people that are seeing it in different ways. And I spent time with fish biologists and scientists that are working on the river. But I also wanted to talk to people that had lived their entire lives there and had perhaps a different perspective from the scientific method and different ways of understanding what was going on. One of those characters was Andy Basich. Andy had been drawn to Alaska, perhaps like me, perhaps like a lot of the gold rushers who went to Alaska for the first time as young men looking for adventure. Andy had turned up in a town called Eagle on the 3rd of July, and he'd stuck around for the 4th of July celebrations, and 40 years later, he was still there. Andy had bought a bit of land about 12 miles out of Eagle because the tiny little town of Eagle was a little bit busy for him. People have these territories out here in the same way that animals have territories. They need enough space for a fish net and some decent hunting grounds and enough space to think. And I met people that were doing it in all sorts of different ways, from Vietnam veterans that had gone there after the war to be by themselves, incredibly misanthropic individuals who wanted no contact with anyone,
extremely Christian families who are homeschooling their kids far from any away from any other sort of influence. And Andy explained to me that everyone does the bush in their own way. When I first got out here, he says, there was a guy living down at Coal Creek. He came back onto the veranda and handed me a chilled glass of homemade beer. All he really did all winter was sit in front of his window, Andy said. He'd read and he'd read and he'd smoke some dope and he'd read. He'd do as little work as he could to prevent himself from freezing to death. Maybe he'd go and shoot a moose or a bear if it came into that window. He didn't have a pot to piss in, and he was happy as a clam. It wouldn't have made me happy, but it worked for him. Me, I like to work. I like to create stuff. Sorry, say that one. Andy's setup is what happens when an architect has removed from the equation the slightest constraint of space. Where other people have rooms, Andy has buildings. There is a sauna. There are guest cabins. There is a workshop and a tool shed and a cache, and several other buildings whose purpose remains a mystery. He lives in a two-story construction with a porch, and he is at work building a new place for himself on the other side of the yard, piles of spruce planks stacked beside it that he has ripped from logs cut from the forest. There are drying racks, where hundreds of brown and brittle chum clack together in the river's wind, and greenhouses, where starts of cabbages and tomatoes and chilies and marijuana jostle for space in their short and frantic season. There are nest boxes for swallows. They keep the mosquitoes down. There is one shelter dedicated to the building of boats, the shell of a kayak, steam-bent and wood-framed, suspended from the rafters. On a far-off bit of his land, he is setting up some yurts. Back in the old days, it had been busy out here, if one's concept of busy was fairly fluid, much distorted from years of remote bush living. But there had been families and youngsters like himself. It might take you a couple of weeks for a round trip to Eagle, lining the canoes upriver, a few days in town getting some business done, getting some drinking done, and then the float back down. People would keep an eye on things while you were away, dog sit, babysit. Now there was a new cabin to be built, everyone pitched in. Now, Andy says, the land feels empty. Young people didn't move here anymore. It was just the old codgers like himself getting older every year, and they were a dying breed. Old Dick Cook was taken by the river a few years ago, and he got lucky. Most of them would end up forgotten in a retirement home someplace. No one to look after them but some pretty nurse. Any family that they might have had long since moved out of state. When Andy's time came, he planned to build a raft and float off down the river. The young people, they come up here and they see what I've got and they expect to have it right away, he says. They don't know that this takes time. They don't see the billions of calories I've used up building this place. Even clearing a little patch of land in the forest without machines, that's a lot of work. He smiles and sips at his beer. They don't want to put in all that effort if they don't own the land. But no one owns the land. Just because I've got a bit of paper that says I do, it's not mine when I die. The payoff is in the experience gained. But they don't see it like that. I spoke to Andy about the changes that he'd seen. Andy, for most of his time out in the bush, had made his living, and you have to make some sort of money in the bush these days. You need to buy repairs for your outboard motor, you need to buy diesel, you need to buy coffee and sugar and a thousand things that people never used to need. And for a long time, Andy worked as a commercial fisherman. He told me that back in the day when he first got there, the king salmon were absolutely enormous. Once upon a time, they were called June hogs. A good sized fish was about 80 pounds. The biggest king ever caught was 126 pounds, which is the upper limit of a featherweight boxer. Now Andy told me a big fish was about 20 pounds. The reason for this, he explained, is because the Yukon was the last unregulated salmon fishery in the world, and the fishermen would select, as you understandably would, for the biggest fish. And salmon being so genetically specific as they are, going back to the same birthing pool year on year on year, it doesn't take very long to start to screw those genetics. And because the fish are now smaller, they're laying less eggs. These massive mythic beasts of the past might have laid 20,000 eggs. And salmon run an absolute gauntlet during their lives. From the little par heading down to the rivers, going out to sea, their adult lives coming back, they can be eaten by a myriad of things, of seals and otters and killer whales. And then there's the fishing and there's log jams and there's pollution. And a massive fish like this laying 20,000 eggs might be lucky to have five of her children return. Now the fish are about 20 pounds, it's more like 1 to 1. And that means that any of the other things which are starting to affect the king salmon, whether that's overfishing out in the oceans, the bycatch by pollock trawlers, whether that's a changing climate, the warmer oceans are starting to cause the spread of diseases, distress fish, which are really reliant on cold water, as the salmon are, changing migration patterns of the salmon's prey. There's a lot less resilience in that system. So although salmon numbers have always fluctuated, the fact that that resilience has been taken away, they're much, much more vulnerable than they used to be. Andy still fishes the chum salmon, but he doesn't make any money from that anymore. Those are for his sled dogs. And what Andy now does in order to make his money is star in a reality TV show. This is Andy on the right here, second from the right with his partner, Kate. And there's an enormous market now for these reality TV shows in Alaska. It's a strange payoff for rural remoteness that for about 4 months of the year, Andy will have a National Geographic crew turn up and dog his every single move. But from this one, Life Below Zero, there's Ice Road Truckers, Deadliest Catch, Bering Sea Gold, Alaska's Wild Gourmet, Alaskan Bush People, Flying Wild Alaska, Sarah Palin's Alaska, The Last Alaskans, Alaska the Last Frontier. Almost like the gold or the oil before, there's this market which has now been tapped that people on what Alaskans call the outside, like members of a cult, people on the outside want. And yet Andy isn't particularly happy with this new way of life. There's a real nostalgia that I felt going down the river, and I found that talking to people about the salmon was a way of opening up much bigger questions. One of the wonderful things about researching this trip was everywhere I went, the hospitality that I was offered along the way, and people would, when I told them I was researching salmon, they would invite me in. I'd turned up in a canoe and people were interested in what I was doing. People would ask me to sit down and share their food with them. And we'd eat salmon in a myriad of ways, from sushi to barbecue to smoke to grill to raw. And over these dinners, as we shared food, people would ask me, I would ask people about the salmon, and it would bring up all these other questions. People would talk to them about what food meant to them or what they hoped for their children as time went on. People would talk about what it means to be indigenous in 21st century America, or how it is that capitalism and subsistence can now exist side by side. And it's obviously far too simple to attribute a lot of the changes that are happening in Alaska now to the lack of salmon, because there are a lot of changes happening, and it's been particularly the indigenous villages have found it hard to weather what's been going on recently. Alcohol abuse has become rampant in villages, domestic violence, child abuse, suicide. There's a legacy of changes which have happened from the gold rush onwards that I came to see has been really playing havoc with people's lives. This woman, Mary Dementiev, is now in her 80s. She's an Athabascan elder. She had 12 children. She's got hundreds of grandchildren, and it's her life story now stretches the length and breadth of Alaska. Mary was one of many people who was taken when she was about 7 years old to a residential boarding school that was run by Catholics. And Mary had a very complicated relationship with how she thought about religion, and it was very important to her, and she really identified as a Catholic. And it was only starting to research people's lives when I came back that I started to find the legacy of these boarding schools and the terrifying amount of abuse that went on. And there's far too much to really get into in this talk now. I go into it in quite in depth in the book, but I'm just going to read one section, which is about the residential schools, because it's this other hidden aspect of life on the Yukon which generally gets ignored in the stories about Alaska and the wilderness and the beauty of it. Madeline Jackson is one of two left alive in the village from the first batch of children who were taken. Trucks showed up and loaded them in and shipped them off like cattle. When they took us there, they took our clothes away and gave us school clothes, she said. And once you start talking your language, they strap you with a leather belt that wide and that long. The more you cry, the harder they hit you. And you got to bite your tongue not to cry no more, so they wouldn't give you a spanking. Ellie Ambrose was only that big, and she knew our language only. And I try and tell her, talk English now, Ellie, talk English. Just to hear her, a small kid like that. And I can't do anything, because if I try to help her, I get strapped. About a month, maybe 2 months after that, she finally realized. She come to me and she said, I know what you're telling me. I'm going to try hard to talk white man now. Now she can talk white man, but she only talk a little bit Tlingit. There are letters from the time, shaky handwriting in broken English, from desperate mothers to distant men. I am the mother of Maggie Linklater, and I would like to have her home for summer holiday. She has not been home since she went to school, and we would like to have her home once. I do not want her to stay at school till she is 18. That is too long. When they are too long at school, they won't have anything to do with us. They grow away from us. I am broken up, you sending my daughter's little babies to Carcross. It's too much for me how this is what you want to do. As a local Canadian paper explained to readers in 1917, it is frequently quite a difficult matter to induce the parents to part with their children, especially for a number of years. But this natural prejudice will, doubtless, gradually be overcome. Unlike the United States, Canada has gone some way in trying to repair the damage done. A Truth and Reconciliation Commission was established in 2008, just 12 years after the last residential school closed, and concluded its work in 2015. Modelled on the South African model for redressing the wounds of apartheid, the commission travelled across the country, collecting statements from approximately 6,000 First Nations people who had attended the boarding schools. Of the 150,000 children taken over the course of the 120-year period that they were open, at least 3,200 died in the schools. And of the 70,000 pupils who are still alive, over 35,000 cases of sexual assault have now been brought. Stephen Harper, then Prime Minister, issued a formal apology in 2008. And in 2015, the Commission concluded that the government had separated children from their parents, not to educate them, but primarily to break their link to their culture and identity. These measures were part of a coherent policy to eliminate Aboriginal people as distinct peoples and to assimilate them into the Canadian mainstream against their will. Madeleine Jackson pointed out that no one has ever apologised to the parents. It was tough for them, she said. Only way they would show their emotion is when they get drunk and they start crying. And they say, why did they have to take my kids away? It's not until they took the kids away from home, that's when everybody started drinking. Everybody, even the women, all over. The whole Canada, I guess, was like that. And all the women and men start drinking and drinking and drinking because it's the only way they can forget their pain. This is the ongoing legacy of the project to get the savage out of the Indian. Alcoholism, suicide, shame, community breakdown, cycles of abuse. Dwayne Alkin, Madeline's nephew, is a generation removed from those who were taken to the schools. I didn't suffer within a residential school per se, he said to me. I suffered within the residential school that came to my community, that came to my family. So instead of me being dragged away, it was dragged to me. He told me that for the number of generations it took to reach this place of hurt, it will take the same number to get back. He speaks of the Tlingit phase, Hakusti. It means our way of life, he says. How we live, how we think, how we do, how we carry ourselves. All that was strong before residential schools. Our elders are helping to bring back Hakusti. But there's a lot of our younger people who are still learning. They're having to try to purge themselves of the Western ideas of just me, the individualistic viewpoint. They're starting to realise there is a bigger community, and that community extends beyond the current generation. Such gatherings as Fish Camp, he says, are crucial for this work. So as I say, it's much too simple to connect the stories which have happened to the Indigenous people and to the white incomers with the decline in the salmon. And the salmon has been politicised in that way. There are politicians which will point to the decline as the salmon as the only one thing that we need to fix in order to solve a lot of the other problems. But it is very integral. And I suppose what I took back from the Yukon more than anything else is seeing those very interwoven connections between the people and the place and the fish. And I realised that when you start to pull on one of these things, when the salmon starts to disappear, everything else is affected as well. And I feel that probably is the same for England. It's just that those connections have become much more obscure because we get our food from the supermarket and our water from the tap, and we're unaware of those much more complicated networks, whereas along the Yukon, it felt like those things were stripped back to their bare bones. And I don't just mean those things changing in a catastrophic way. I mean those connections between people and place and the fish is very positive things as well, that the culture and the importance are extremely interwoven and all those things feel like they feed off each other. And I'm just going to finish by reading a quote from the foreword of this book, which was written by a gentleman called Harold Johnson. He's a Cree elder. He's a fisherman and he's a writer and he's a lawyer. And he was kind enough to write the foreword to the Canadian edition. And he finishes the foreword by saying, "Why don't the salmon come back? Did we forget to put their bones back in the river? Did we stop respecting them? Will they ever come back? We know. We have always known. What we do to the land, what we do to the river, what we do to the air, we do also to ourselves. That's the law. That has always been the law. And the law is not going to change because we forgot it. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.